Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is March 6, 2019, and this is episode 128. Politicos is a BC politics podcast. Tell us what you think of the show by leaving us a review or get at us on social media. Most importantly, help us build the show by throwing us a couple bucks a month at patreon.com/politicos.
I'm Scott Glenboom.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, yes, more SNC-Lavalin. And then we get to bring repeated guest Micah back on to talk about the court ruling that recently happened updating the battle between the Vancouver Aquarium and the Park Board over whales. Longtime listeners will remember our Micah Was Wrong segment that he has cursed us for since, and we can bring back a Micah Was Actually Right After All segment. Politicos, as always, is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicos, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your two-week trial of the newsletter, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca. First up, an attempted rebuttal. Get it? Lots more happening in the SNC-Lavalin front, as we've been talking about for weeks now.
Yes, in fact, tomorrow is going to be the one-month anniversary of the scandal breaking.
And tomorrow morning, like after I've already released this, Trudeau will have made some kind of announcement, which, I don't know, might be this statement of contrition that was leaked to CBC, or, I don't know, might just be another nothing burger press conference like he did right after Jody Wilson-Raybould's testimony.
And after Jane Philpott resigned, which brings us into Jane Philpott resigned.
So Jane Philpott was Minister of Health, widely respected, and then she moved to Indigenous Affairs, I believe?
Yes.
And then was also Treasury Board Secretary?
Briefly, yes. And was, I can't recall if it was assistant or deputy, but basically the number two person under Treasury Board Secretary as well, when she was pulling double duty as Indigenous Affairs and Treasury Board Deputy.
And so unlike Jody Wilson-Raybould's resignation, Philpott's was very pointed. We were reading between the lines when Jody Wilson-Raybould resigned and when she released her statement after the cabinet shuffle. When Philpott resigned, she flat out said, this is because of what the government has done on SNC-Lavalin.
Yes. In her letter, she says, unfortunately, the evidence of efforts by politicians and or officials to pressure the former attorney general to intervene in the criminal case involving SNC-Lavalin and the evidence as to the content of those efforts have raised serious concerns for me. Those concerns have been augmented by the views expressed by my constituents and other Canadians. Like, that leaves very little room for ambiguity on exactly why she's resigning. And she then goes on to say that, sadly, I have lost confidence how the government has dealt with this matter and in how it has responded to the issues raised.
There's not many lines to read between there. It's very direct. It's very clear. The partisan response seemed to have been, well, Philpott is just friends with Jody Wilson-Raybould, so this is just like girls getting each other's backs.
Yeah, that was what Bill Morneau said shortly after the resignation, which
not great.
Took off like a lead balloon, and
yeah.
I don't think anyone's tried that since.
So setting aside that terrible response and reply, a cabinet minister resigning is usually a big deal. In this case, it's a huge deal because she ends by saying, I have no confidence in this government, and they fucked up real royally.
Jane Philpott isn't one of those cabinet ministers who I think has gotten a lot of play kind of outside the Ottawa bubble. But for context, she is widely respected by basically everyone in Ottawa and kind of seen as the person you put in a difficult file if you want results.
I think it's a testimony to her strength as a minister how many times she hasn't been in the news.
Yes, on very challenging files. Health, Indigenous Affairs, like those are the types of files that when you're in the news a lot, it's generally pretty bad.
Yeah, things were going smoothly because she's smart, talented, and capable.
Yes, and like this is her, she's a first-term MP, first elected in the 2015 election, you know, really has kind of set herself apart. So this is really big in a way that I think maybe the name recognition alone doesn't indicate.
So the other big story this week on the SNC-Lavalin affair was this morning and into this afternoon, the Justice Committee was meeting again, and after last week hearing from Jody Wilson-Raybould, today we got to hear from Gerald Butts, former principal secretary to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and one who allegedly said, there's no solution that doesn't involve some interference. What did we learn from Mr. Butts' testimony?
Not a whole lot. Gerald Butts, who's been friends with the Prime Minister since university and kind of one of the brains behind the whole Liberal campaign and government, he resigned a couple weeks ago and was kind of the first casualty of this affair beyond Jody Wilson-Raybould herself. And today we got his side of the story, which, like, if you were in a bubble in the last month and hadn't heard any of the other stuff, everything he said kind of plausibly fit together, just not with any of the other stuff we know about this.
Yeah, so I didn't see his testimony itself because I didn't realize it was happening first thing this morning, Pacific Standard Time, but I did manage to turn on as the questions were starting. And that's where things, I think, really started to unravel for him, particularly, and again, I have to give a lot of credit to Lisa Raitt, who was just fantastic on this. She pulled out specific things that, for example, Jody Wilson-Raybould said, and she said, if this is how these facts occurred, you would agree that's unacceptable and inappropriate, right? Or are you calling her a liar? And Gerald Butts has to sort of say, well, I'm not going to besmirch anyone's reputation here. And I just remember things
lines, though, differently. He's basically has to call her a liar, but he's not going to do it directly. It's probably worth circling back a bit to kind of the main component of the opening statements and his version of events, which is largely, we didn't really talk about it at all. There was a few meetings. In fact, Jody Wilson-Raybould asked for a couple of herself. We didn't really say anything appropriate. This was such a non-issue for me that my calendar only shows we had one internal meeting, which is odd when he also said that, you know, if you're not meeting like 10 times a day on a file, it's not, it's not important, but clearly it was important enough for them to feel it needed a second opinion on everything. And that there was no pressure, but only, we just really want to make sure there's a second opinion available. And that was the only thing that was discussed. It was just are you sure you've thought this through enough? Because we can get someone in to walk you through the legislation your department wrote.
It's not patronizing. It's just, why wouldn't you want former Supreme Court justice to write an opinion? Why wouldn't that help?
Never really answering the question of, would it actually help?
Indeed. Yeah, he definitely tried to play a few different lines. And the charitable reading is that he is earnest here and didn't see anything he did as crossing a line, and perhaps never believed she had really come to a decision, or he viewed the rules as saying, until there is a specific court judgment.
Until the verdict comes down, it's always open.
It's always open to revisiting this, which is not a great approach to the justice system, given, you know, are we cutting deals when all of the evidence has been heard in court? I know it's technically true.
And that's, I think, what kind of comes out most strong about this is that, and I'm going to try to Andrew Coyne for, I think, being the one to say this first, is that, like, the takeaway from this is that Gerald Butts sees policy outcomes and political staff bringing those to the AG's attention as something that should be routine rather than exceptional. And that the AG's direction to the prosecution service should be something that's routine rather than exceptional.
Which is not great for the independence of said prosecutor. So we get those different elements of his testimony. Like I said, the questions really tore into this from the Conservatives. Murray Rankin, also from NDP, tore into him. Elizabeth May, at the end, managed to bring up, I think, what you brought up last week, which is SNC doesn't actually employ that many people, and they also have a lot of very secure contracts. So the idea that they're just going to go under if they face some consequences for their actions seems ludicrous. Wouldn't you agree, Mr. Butts?
He was not able to give a good answer on that.
It was one of those more of a comment than a question questions, but that's okay. She did it well. The Liberals, again, it's so frustrating. So Randy Boissonneau especially, I think, was trying to just play defense for Butts and, like, help him. Like, really, he brought up Trans Mountain Pipeline and, like, how many meetings did you have for that? And he's like, I don't know. I don't want to hazard a guess. No, like, ballpark figure. Like, dozens, hundreds? It's like, yeah, probably like 100 meetings when they bought the pipeline. Meanwhile, we only had like 10 meetings by Jody Wilson-Raybould's testimony on this. So clearly this wasn't important. And it's a way of like trying to deflect and also trivialize the fact that they're very different discussions. Like no one questions the prime minister talking to his ministers on any number of files, but it's when you're going to the attorney general whose job is to be independent.
Nobody expects natural resources to not have political and policy discussions with the PMO over everything. That is not the case with the prosecution service.
So there is that element of the liberals, but where I think the liberals really did themselves a disservice was, and they were basically set up for this, there are two motions put out by the opposition in the midst of all these questions. One from Lisa Raitt saying, can we get all of the texts, emails, everything Mr. Butts has relating to this affair to all the people mentioned, you know, the prime minister down? Basically trying to say, that's great that you've read these into the record, but let's see the receipts, prove it. Is there anything maybe hidden on a personal phone? Let's just make sure we have it all. Hard to object to that. Yet the five liberals on the committee did manage to object to it and overruled the four opposition members, meaning we do not have said records.
Yeah, and that's the real problem with the Justice Committee as the method by which this is getting resolved, is that it's a partisan committee. Like, the Liberals have a majority in Parliament and they have a majority on the committee. And as long as that remains true, you really aren't going to get an independent inquiry into this. And that's why there needs to be an independent inquiry.
And the other motion, just for completeness, came from the NDP just after Mr. Butts had been dismissed, saying, can we bring Jody Wilson-Raybould back to answer some of these discrepancies? Because they did bring Michael Wernick back.
Yeah, not only that, is Jerry Butts had a different interpretation of what the order in council lifting the privileges covered, and felt free to talk about stuff that Jody Wilson-Raybould felt wasn't covered by that order in council. So there's stuff that he talked about, namely the reason for the cabinet shuffle.
And which role Jody Wilson-Raybould ended up in, and I think this is the real meat that we buried deeply.
And she didn't talk about that at all, because under her interpretation, that was covered. And it's, I think, very clear that she needs to discuss it if it's now part of the open conversation. Regarding the reasons for the shuffle, it was the argument advanced was that Scott Bryson's leaving, we need to fill that spot, so, okay, we're going to promote Jane Philpott to Treasury Board Secretary. That means we need to fill her seat, and it needs to be someone, you know, of high stature, because, you know, this is a file that's very important to the Prime Minister, and, you know, we need to show that we're serious about reconciliation. Well, why don't we just move the Attorney General over there?
And Jody Wilson-Raybould is a strong supporter of the government's effort to work towards reconciliation, or at least, if anything, she's been frustrated by its lack of progress, allegedly. And so maybe your first intuition is, yeah, she'd be great in it. She has a history as an Indigenous woman working with these communities. But that shallow intuition would be wrong, because if you know anything about Jody Wilson-Raybould or many Indigenous leaders, they don't look kindly on that department, which many still call Indian Affairs, mainly because it still manages the very racist Indian Act, which you don't ask the Indigenous person to become the, like, chief of the colonial state power.
Yeah, I think there's been a general consensus among Indigenous leaders that that's not really a role that an Indigenous person should fill.
Yeah, it looks bad. It looks like you're a traitor, essentially.
And the fact that they didn't think about this, for a government that apparently can't decide, you know, what color pen to use without doing 40 meetings, this seems pretty slapdashed as a cabinet shuffle.
Well, and with Jody Wilson-Raybould's dad, after she was announced going to Veterans Affairs, his comment was, the only thing the government looks down more upon than Veterans Affairs is Indian Affairs, roughly. So,
yeah,
great. Good job.
But the reason she ended up in Veterans Affairs is she told the Prime Minister no. She didn't want the job. And apparently that was unprecedented enough that they didn't want to create any sort of precedent. So they decided, well, since he said no, she has to move anyway. So we'll put her in veterans.
Rolled the dice. So that was pretty damning on its own to come out.
And it's also worth noting that it was revealed that Jane Philpott had raised the issue during this process that Jody Wilson-Raybould thinks this has something to do with SNC. And was basically told, oh, no, it has nothing to do with that. But it probably does. Pretty much every indication we have is it does have something to do with that. And even if we grant that that was not the reasons why, the fact that they didn't clue into that this could be a problem says a lot.
So a couple more points on Jerry Butts. He claimed that basically last week when Jody Wilson-Raybould testified was the first time he learned that she had any feeling that this might be untoward pressure coming from the PMO, which seems to directly contradict all of her.
Send a letter, like a dear sir, please stop harassing my office letter. But like from what she said, it was pretty much every conversation that anyone from her office had came with the, this is inappropriate, stop talking to us about it. And not only that, two of the PMO staffers who work basically for Jerry Butts were told, this is inappropriate, knock it off. And he just said, I have no idea. It doesn't sound like the sort of conversation they would be having, which, considering how centralized power is in the Canadian system, I find it really hard to believe that the number two person basically in the government practically doesn't know what the Attorney General thinks after 11 different meetings.
The other thing that I want to pull out was going back to Lisa Raitt's questions. She had a fantastic question right near the start where she pulls out this one anecdote from Jody Wilson-Raybould's testimony where she says that the Prime Minister's office knew what, like, the deputy director at the public prosecutor's...
Yeah, we talked a bit about this last week, and yeah, Lisa Raitt picked up on it as well and asked some very pointed questions on that.
So thanks for listening to the podcast, Lisa Raitt. But yeah, how does the PMO know what the deputy prosecutors are thinking unless there is someone talking there? And Butts didn't really have an answer to that.
Yeah, like that alone could be a scandal. I think those are the main highlights of the testimony. Overall, I just didn't really find it very convincing. Where last week's testimony was filled with supporting documentation and like verbatim quotes, this one was a lot more iffy. There was a lot more I do not recalls or I can't imagine that person doing that. It was nowhere near as credible. Jerry Butts presented himself as someone who was confident and sincere.
Well, yeah.
Whether or not he is sincere is, I think, an open question, but the demeanor of both of them, I think, would lend a casual observer to generally believe what they're saying.
Where she was able to, like you said, back up with facts, and she held her answers to that. Nevertheless, she's accused of speaking her truth, and he's testifying. I think we're hearing Jerry Butts' truth, and Jody Wilson-Raybould gave us the detailed account. But he, in the questions, you saw it especially, wandered more, had less exact answers, or where he didn't want to answer, he was still willing to sort of go dance around, versus Wilson-Raybould would say, let me say this. I'm going to choose my words very carefully, and then I'm going to stop talking.
Yeah, so after Jerry Butts' testimony, I think the provisional conclusion people should be drawn from this is that Jody Wilson-Raybould's version is much more likely to be correct and that there is improper activities been going on around this.
Well, and then we move on this afternoon, and I didn't have the chance to really watch this one, but I read a couple of the follow-ups. Like I mentioned, Clerk of the Privy Council, Michael Wernick, was invited back to give a second take at his views on what happened and allow MPs to question him once more.
Joining him as well was Nathalie Durand, the Deputy Minister of Justice and Attorney General.
Did we learn anything from either of these people other than Wernick is still really concerned about the internet?
Yes. He started off his opening statement with an only slightly less confusing opening statement than last time.
He didn't talk about anyone getting assassinated today?
Nope. Just alleged that there was witnessed intimidation and cyberbullying, and apparently had curated a bunch of social media posts that he brought with printed out versions of that nobody on the committee seemed all that interested in taking a look at.
Mainly because they weren't there to talk about cyberbullying and the internet. They were
yeah.
there to talk about SNC-Lavalin, I think.
Reading between the lines, I think this is clerk.mean tweets is basically what it amounted to. And it's Twitter is going to happen, and he did himself no favors last time on that. You know, if anything crossed the line into cyberbullying, that's obviously not okay, but it's not clear that there is anything beyond just normal Twitter snark at work. Anyway, that's how it started off, and it wasn't, I think, a particularly high note to start on, considering he was pretty widely criticized last time for an alarmist opening statement that was at best tangentially related to the matter at hand.
At least he has a format or a template for his statements.
Yeah.
But let's move on and talk about Quebec, because he had thoughts about the Quebec government.
Yeah, so one of the major bombshells of the former AG's testimony was that the Quebec election got raised as a reason to let SNC-Lavalin off the hook, or grant them a deferred prosecution agreement, which only partially lets them off the hook. Now, his explanation for this was that, well, it's federal government policy to just steer clear of elections of other levels of government. And, you know, I was only pointing out that this is a purely federal issue that could just potentially protrude upon the Quebec election and might have some undue influence over that. Do you find that a credible response?
It's amazing. There was something I think that even came up in the questions with Gerald Butts, that there was this like confusion over whether the Prime Minister's office had been communicating with the Premier of Quebec, either Philippe Couillard or François Legault, before or after the election about this whole SNC thing. And he was kind of like, no, well, actually, okay, maybe there was one call or something. And you're like, wait, what? Like, it's not a minor thing to be not just, you know, pressing the AG from multiple angles, having back channels with the prosecution service, but also like communicating with another level of government about this whole situation. So
yeah,
I get the like, yeah, we want to work together on this important political file. Like, undoubtedly, the government of Canada was working with the government of Alberta when the TMX pipeline came up. But again, that's not part of the independent judiciary.
Yeah, not only that, but okay, there are two potential scenarios here. One in which there's no announcement of a deferred prosecution agreement. Things continue on. The court case continues to drag out. They haven't even entered trial yet. The election comes and goes. No real indication anything happened. I mean, that's the version of events that happens in this timeline. The other one is that, okay, she grants the deferred prosecution agreement. Suddenly, there's a big news story about SNC-Lavalin in the middle of a Quebec election. The political interference route is the only one that actually leads to this being an issue that affects the Quebec election. So why discuss the Quebec election if not to try and get it that way?
Other major takeaways from Wernick's testimony and questions?
So once again, Lisa Wright had some very good questions and was clearly the best cross-examiner there by quite a bit. I think Murray Rankin being a distant second. And she really pressed the clerk over the communications that happened between him and SNC-Lavalin. And last time the clerk had said, oh, no, nothing. There was no contact at all. This time it was, okay, there was a little contact.
There's some minor interference.
Yes. With the guy who had my job before now, who's now the chairman of the board of SNC-Lavalin. We did have a call there. Wright quite reasonably asked, okay, so if you're saying no to everyone from SNC-Lavalin except the guy who used to have your job, doesn't that breach the Conflict of Interest Act, where that would mean where the former clerk is basically using his former position to have special access to the government, which is a big no-no? Never really got a good answer on that one.
No one's going to say, yes, I'm clearly guilty of...
Well, no, yes, that guy's... Yes, the chairman of the SNC board is clearly guilty of some. This wouldn't have been something that Michael Wernick would be in trouble for. It would be maybe not really talking about enough last time. It would be the former clerk.
So, yeah, it sounds like largely didn't do himself any favors.
No. In fact, in terms of general temperament, I think he was not the calm and collected person that his co-witness, the Deputy Minister of Justice and AG, was. She was quite a good example of what a civil servant is supposed to be at these sorts of committee hearings. You know, to the point, only speaking within the knowledge she has, not editorializing at all. Can't really say the same for the clerk. And it's just looking over the notes I took here, I don't think I really pulled out anything of like fireworks from her, which is probably a good sign. It was mostly clarifying questions about, okay, what were the communications? Okay, you prepared this legal opinion, but didn't send it off. Do you explain why? You know, all these sorts of things that basically help fill out some of the details, but nothing that was really a bombshell. There was a few testy exchanges between people, and like Pierre Poilievre was asking questions, so that's pretty much guaranteed to happen. He wanted to know why the clerk brought up that, oh, SNC might move their headquarters, even though it was a matter of public record that their loan, I think it was a loan agreement with the federal government, mean they couldn't move for another 6 years, and that 2 days before he is alleged to have brought this, oh, they might move concern up with the AG, that SNC came out and said, oh no, we're not moving because we can't. So like, there's just a lot of things like that. And Poilievre was his partisan attack dodge self, but like those were very valid questions, and we didn't get good answers out of the clerk on that as well. He just kind of defaulted back to the, oh, it was public record, and you know, it's nothing really to see here. But I think what was the moment that most stood out for me, and is when Maya Warnick made a point of saying Jody Wilson-Raybould testified that no criminal behavior took place. And then several, and I mean, like, it wasn't just one person, the person asking questions at the time, several people more or less at the same time said, that's the standard, which the, oh, nothing was technically illegal is a bad look when a politician does it. It's even worse when a member of the civil service uses that as their defense.
Oh, this is just too amusing. Yep.
There's really not much you can say about that, but I think it just goes to show that this wasn't the typical sort of testimony one would expect from a member of the civil service.
Yeah.
So there wasn't a huge amount more we learned. What was the potential new information question that has been dogging the liberals on the, well, we just wanted to make sure she was aware of all this stuff. And, you know, it's totally reasonable for an AD to reconsider if there's new information.
Yeah, Jerry Butts brought this up a few times.
The new information, according to the clerk, was their share price went down. And a provincial premier contacted us saying that he doesn't like where this is going. Not exactly the sort of thing to...
Yeah, I don't think most people would view those facts as substantively changing the situation around a criminal prosecution.
Yeah. And just the other thing I wanted to bring up is Justice Frank Iacobucci's name came up several times during this. He is SNC-Lavalin's lawyer.
Former Supreme Court Justice.
And a former Supreme Court Justice.
They're just all over the place. And we'll have one more to talk about later.
Yes. He is also the Trans Mountain envoy from Trudeau, which... And it also came out that the only contact the clerk had with him was when he bumped into him in the hallway at a Liberal cabinet meeting. So the question I have is, why is the lawyer of a company under criminal prosecution being appointed to stuff by the Prime Minister and hanging around the Liberals?
Lawyers do have pretty strict code of ethics where if they are in conflict, they take themselves off the files. And I'm assuming a former Supreme Court justice knows that much better than I just explained it. So
but like
he's operating above board, but the optics aren't great.
Yeah, and there's been calls for him to resign as the Trans Mountain envoy, which not entirely unreasonable. But yeah, it just, I think, raises a lot of questions. And at the very least, I think there needs to, once the dust has settled from this, there does need to be a serious look at, okay, just what does it mean when a company's under criminal prosecution? Should the Lobbying Act, for example, prohibit them from lobbying a government if they're currently being criminally prosecuted? That probably might have avoided everyone getting into this mess because we wouldn't have had a deferred prosecution agreement and multiple contact afterwards to kind of nudge them in the right direction.
Well, that's been this, you know, very eventful few days, essentially.
Yeah, I've picked quite the time to take Twitter off my phone as kind of a social media break. Bad timing on my part.
It's fine. Twitter's an awful website, as Michael Warnick has informed us today. Well, at least we're going to expect one more mini cabinet shuffle as they need to find someone to fill Treasury Board.
Yes, and who knows what NetSuite's cabinet shuffle's going to be, the rate they're going. I'm just imagining somewhere in the PMO, like some workers are changing the, it's been 0 days since a cabinet shuffle sign.
For our next segment, we're going to Micah Was Right. Welcome back to Politicoast, Micah Goldberg.
Thanks for having me back on.
So recently, the issue of the Vancouver Aquarium versus the Vancouver Park Board, well, now it's Oceanwise, whatever, Conservation Society versus the Park Board, went back to court. Court of Appeal came down with a ruling, and you're feeling vindicated.
I'm feeling very vindicated. I'm going to take the half dozen of you actually listening to this segment back to June 23rd, 2017, when I said on this honorable program that the aquarium would not win their court case against the Parks Board. And I had so much egg on my face after the Supreme Court decision. I didn't know if I'd ever be able to appear on this program again. But here I am, I'm back, because the Court of Appeal basically took everything I said in that first podcast episode and put it in their reasons.
It was basically a podcast by, or a factum by podcast.
Yeah. I mean, I'm being very facetious right now. That's not actually what happened, but it's not that far.
Then they cleaned
off
up the language a bit.
Yeah, there was less beer consumed, I imagine, when the Court of Appeal was writing its reasons.
Well, so let's go back to the start for those who forget the case or didn't keep up with it at the time. The Park Board, led by some green councillors, green commissioners, have been trying for years to ban cetaceans and the keeping of whales and dolphins and porpoises in captivity. And they brought in a bylaw a few years back, I believe, at the Park Board level to ban it and say the aquarium can't keep belugas anymore. And the aquarium, having a 40-some million dollar expansion plan predicated on not getting more whales into captivity, but giving the whales they had better captivity in theory, thought that was an infringement of their rights.
Yes. This was right after, I think it was, two whales had died in captivity at the aquarium. And so it spurred the Parks Board to do something about it, to pass this bylaw which would restrict the aquarium's ability to keep cetaceans and to have these shows or...
They do, like, edutainment kind of things where they feed them but make it a spectacle.
It's not like SeaWorld,
no.
Right? But it's also putting these animals on public display for people in a not truly leave them alone type way. It's more interactive with the crowd. In any event, the aquarium wanted to show the cetaceans off. The Parks Board had some issue with that following these deaths. So they passed this bylaw, restricts the aquarium's ability to do certain things. The aquarium is pissed. They say it's because of the welfare of the animals is now in jeopardy. But like Ian said, there's also these millions of dollars that the aquarium happened to invest, which may or may not have played a role. It certainly played a role in both the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals decisions. But I digress. The aquarium starts this lawsuit making several arguments, one of which is that there was this lease agreement between the board and the aquarium, which, among other things, gives the aquarium the control over day-to-day activities and the ability to more or less control what happens within the aquarium. And what the aquarium says is that the lease agreement has the effect of giving them the power to decide whether or not cetaceans can be displayed, whether or not they can keep cetaceans in the park. The Parks Board is like, wait a second. This agreement that we make can't fetter our abilities as legislators. In other words, as a Parks Board, we can't give away our powers under the Vancouver Charter in a licensing agreement.
Okay, so fast forward to the decision.
Okay, so this at the Supreme Court... Or I'll just back up 1 second. On this show, I say it's a no-brainer. I said there's no way that the aquarium is going to win because through the lens of judicial referral to elected bodies, you know, judges don't like interfering with municipal decisions, publicly elected individuals making choices within their jurisdictions unless they actually need to, like in a charter-type case. Generally speaking, they would prefer to defer to elected decision makers, because if people don't like that decision, they toss out the decision makers, they get in new decision makers. And we saw this in the Como case, right? In the Free the Beer case, the Supreme Court of Canada, during oral submissions, more or less said, look, if Canadians really want better interjurisdictional trade, get new legislators who are willing to enact policies that accomplish that. And I also say, I can't imagine a scenario in which the court will allow the Parks Board in, say, 1999 to bind the hands of the 2018 Parks Board when they're trying to use the same jurisdictional powers. You shouldn't be able to bind the hands of a future parliament. Otherwise, you're going to have Harper, for example, binding the hands of Trudeau, Trudeau binding the hands of someone else.
This is the Balanced Budget Acts can't force really a future government other than they have to repeal the Balanced Budget Act.
Exactly. So, Scott, you asked, so what happens? Well, wrong. Very, very wrong. Justice Mayer hears the case, and he says, which shocked me, Parks Boards aren't like other democratically elected bodies. They're almost like administrative bodies, he says. And therefore, the Parks Board's jurisdiction over the park is not paramount to its lease-making abilities in the Vancouver Charter. So more or less, it can fetter its decision-making abilities by entering into leases, and that was the case with the aquarium. And reading between the lines here, my view was that when it gets down to the level of the Parks Board, which I guess the Supreme Court in this case didn't think of very highly, certainty matters more than binding the hands of lawmakers. So if you're contracting with the Parks Board, you want to make sure you get what you're contracting for. And maybe that's different at other levels. Then the appeal comes down. The egg is off my face. Justice Tiso, writing for Unanimous Court of Appeal, says, hold on, hold on. You cannot bind the hands of lawmakers. He says, anyone the Parks Board deals with can get certainty in business dealings. Because if the Parks Board breaches its licensing agreement or any other agreement, what do? You sue for money. You don't bind the hands of the lawmaker. You get your money back. And in doing so, what I say the Court of Appeal does, they didn't say this explicitly, but my interpretation is they wrap the Parks Board in the same cloth that holds the other democratically elected bodies. So the Parks Board can't bargain away its legislative powers in advance, and the Parks Board must always be in a position to exercise its jurisdictional powers. So it sends the matter back down to the Supreme Court to hear the other arguments from the aquarium, including the very much anticipated freedom of expression argument.
Yes. We talked about this a bit, I think, when it first came up, because it's so delightful. Tell our listeners again why it's a free speech issue to exploit animals.
If I have learned one thing through my experience in judging this case, it is to not ever judge this case. For all I know, there is some kind of freedom of expression argument here that I do not understand and do not see. In the petition that was filed by the aquarium, it is given the least amount of meat on the bone. It is this sort of holdover argument. The specter of the charter exists in this case.
It's like, we might as well put a charter challenge in here just because.
It's the, you know, 3-point throw from last second. Like, maybe that'll go in if everything else gets tossed.
So I don't understand it, but I refuse to see that egg back on my face. And so I am done for the moment giving any kind of predictions as to which arguments will or won't work. But that, it's a lot of fun to do. Not so much fun to get all of those mentions on Twitter of people telling me to eat crow. I'll take it, though, because this time I guess I get to write all those eggshells back and be like, you were wrong. I'm not sure what the aquarium's litigation strategy is going to be moving forward. You know, they've already agreed that they're not going to have any more cetaceans in the aquarium. So I'm not sure what the point of going back to the Supreme Court to make the arguments that they should be able to. I suppose the one reason why they might is because with this licensing agreement moving forwards now, perhaps they don't want to lose any face and they want to make sure that the Parks Board knows what hoops they're going to have to jump through if they want to further amend the licensing agreement or ignore it. But, you know, if it's me and I'm giving advice, my view is sue the Parks Board. If they have breached this licensing agreement and you're out a whole bunch of money, that's where you can go if it's about the money. I suppose their concerns are more about what are we going to show at the aquarium moving forward. But to me, that would be the next rational step.
I guess there is that argument of we might not be having cetaceans, but we want to have the right to have cetaceans. You know, we entered into this agreement and maybe 10 years down the line, there's this new beluga whale rescued. DFO has said, Department of Fisheries and Oceans has said this is unreleasable. This animal either has to die or go in a pen somewhere. And the aquarium's like, well, we got a couple pens. Can we use them?
Well, if you have a couple pens, that's no problem. If you have a couple pens that are in Stanley Park, you got a problem.
Yeah.
So there's no issue with the aquarium salvaging these endangered creatures somewhere else. Mm-hmm. The Parks Board just says, not here, not in a bathtub. This is their words. Not in a bathtub in the middle of downtown.
Minor exaggeration, but...
a little bit. But I suppose since it's pretty clear now that the Park Board can always revisit any decisions, and we do have a new Park Board, that should that scenario come up, they can always raise that at the time.
Doesn't that seem like the right sort of resolution? Sorry, this is like, you don't need to include this. I just wanted to ask you. Like, to me, it does seem like the right conclusion to reach, not just because I said this in the first podcast and don't want to eat more crow, but because you don't want your legislative bodies to get into contracts with other non-democratically elected bodies and then not be able to change those deals down the road. They can get sued and that's fine. I'm okay with that because corporations should have certainty.
So give, you know, it's more work for you.
Yeah, exactly. It's true.
So I'm not going to ask you to make a prediction, but next steps, this is getting referred back to the BC Supreme Court. We should just be clear that every mention of the Supreme Court up until now is the BC one, not the Canada one. After that, do you think it's going to make it up to the Canadian Supreme Court?
I highly doubt it. Very, very highly doubt it. In theory, considering what the Supreme Court said, British Columbia Supreme Court, said about parks boards, I could see that in theory going up to the Supreme Court of Canada because it is such a novel case. There are no other elected parks boards in North America. That being said, for reasons I addressed earlier, I would be surprised if the aquarium vigorously pursued this litigation, given that the most important argument was struck down. The other two really have to do with the specific process that was followed and the specific bylaw that was passed. The charter argument is an outlier, I think, and if it was a truly strong argument, probably would have been first, the very first argument made, rather than the very last argument that the aquarium's relying on. In other words, I would be very surprised, but I've already been surprised in this litigation. So
no hard predictions, but no. Unlikely.
Books out the window.
Well, between this and Doug Ford's changing Toronto City Council and the initial ruling on that, lower courts, we've learned, can do very surprising things.
Yes, yes, as is my experience on a daily basis. I can't remember which law prof told me, you know, I would be surprised if the Supreme Court did that, but I'm surprised all the time.
Well, I think that's a good place to end it.
All right.
Thank you for coming back, Michael.
Thanks a lot for having me back, boys. And congratulations to the six of you that made it through the entire segment.
Where can those six people find you?
They can find me at the at symbol on your keyboard. Shift 2, I think. Micah Goldberg, MICAHGOLDBERG. Nothing in this segment constitutes legal advice. And I do not represent the views of my employer.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, boys.
Thank you.
Well, moving on to quick takes. Perhaps as a not officially a way to distract from SNC, the health ministry federally today released an interim report on pharmacare. This is from a commission being led by, I believe it's Eric Hoskin, a former Ontario health minister, who's trying to figure out how can we get the healthcare system we have to cover all the drugs Canadians take. Not the cannabis ones that are legalized now, but your prescriptions.
Although I'm sure somebody would love it if the government paid for that.
Actually, some of the cannabis will be covered because medicinal. The main report is due out in June, but they released an interim partial way through set of recommendations today, which were mainly around creating a national drug agency. And this would be a point of the bureaucracy, which could help negotiate bulk purchasing and otherwise try and make it a bit easier to figure out what drugs Canadians are taking, what drugs they need, and how do we make it a bit cheaper. So not pharmacare by any stretch, but a step towards slightly better planning on this, because we have a national health program. People were quick to point out that this interim recommendation did not actually include any budgeting for how much this would take. There was no real guidance on how a pharmacare system would actually work in Canada. Would it be a single payer system? Would it be a government buys and gives everyone the drugs? Would government just subsidize insurance or rebate it? I guess we'll have to wait for June for that. But the one thing they definitely said when announcing this is it's not a distraction.
It's a distraction.
It really got buried too.
Yeah, they're also doing another announcement thing about the moon mission thing we're signed on to with the U.S. Like they basically tried to roll that out actually pretty much a week ago after the last round of testimony, and nobody cared because the government is imploding in a massive scandal and, oh, we're going to spend $85 million a year over the next 24 years to build some more Canada arms and stuff. Isn't really the sort of thing that gets front page news, even in the best of times.
The best Beaverton, one of the better Beaverton headlines I saw last week on this whole affair was Trudeau now thinking electoral reform might be a really good distraction or way to save his ass.
I thought you were going to do about the ones where he announced the Canadian Space Agency is finding a way to send Wilson Raybould to the moon.
Ooh.
Well, moving on. Mainland Jew is back in the news. As I think it was last week, the extradition got one of the chats in the bots it needs to proceed. And then she immediately filed a lawsuit after that.
So Wang Zhu is I guess she's still the chief financial officer of Chinese telecom mega company Huawei that makes phones and 5G networks and allegedly has very deep ties with the Communist Party of China. And a lot of countries are very afraid that if they develop Huawei stuff everywhere, the Chinese government will be spying on them.
We are the only Five Eyes country to not just have a blanket ban on that right now. And then back, I think it was early December, when she was passing through Vancouver as part of a connecting flight, at the request of the United States, Canada arrested her and is right now in the process of extraditing her to the U.S. to face fraud charges.
So she's now, as you mentioned, suing everyone she can.
Before we get into that, it's also worth mentioning that this caused a massive diplomatic spat with China. They're holding several of our citizens effectively as hostages.
They're also pointing out that as much as Canada like to talk about the rule of law around extraditing Wang Zhu, there's this whole other thing we just talked about for 40 minutes that seems to suggest we don't actually give a fuck about rule of law.
It's a little hard to maintain the rule of law is very important to us in the middle of a giant scandal about prosecutorial interference.
So all that's going down. I did hear secondhand that, well, some of her court hearings were happening in downtown Vancouver today. There were massive anti-Chinese protests outside the court that escalated to the point of one person burning the Chinese flag, which seems a bit extreme.
I want to say yes, but there's been this undercurrent of anti-Chinese sentiment in Vancouver for quite a while.
I didn't say unexpected. I said extreme.
Okay, fair enough.
But yeah, so that's all going down.
Yeah. Anyway, I think we should actually circle back to the lawsuit itself, where she's basically alleging that Canada violated her constitutional rights because they didn't actually arrest her right away and basically interrogated her under the pretense of it just being a normal customs check and then arrested her after like a while.
I have no clue how legitimate her claim is. I don't really know anything about that section of the charter jurisprudence in terms of your legal rights. I do know that in general, those rights all extend to people, everyone who is in Canada, regardless of citizenship. So maybe she has a claim, but I mean, she has enough money to hire very smart lawyers. So undoubtedly this will tie up the courts for a bit. And meanwhile, we get more Chinese propaganda against Canada and anti-Chinese sentiment within Canada. So, cool. Well, back at the federal level, the NDP has some bad news this week as two of its highest profile MPs have announced they're not actually going to run again. Two BC MPs, actually, Nathan Cullen from Skeena, Bulkley, Valley, and Murray Rankin from one of the Victoria ridings, are using this as their opportunity to step out of politics, at least for now. In Rankin's case, he's been around for a while. I can see him kind of going off into the sunset. Nathan Cullen, though, is widely respected and still a fairly young guy. He's not even 50. So a lot of people are kind of wondering if both are just stepping away, thinking Singh is running the party in a wrong direction and maybe going to bide their time for better days to come.
Yeah, could be. It's really hard to say. Like, you'd expect a certain amount of turnover every cycle. I think there's been quite a few this time.
I think the NDP is up to something like a third of their caucus isn't running again.
That's a very high turnover.
That's not optimistic.
It's not the sort of turnover you see when you're, you know, on the cusp of government or even official opposition status, if you're a third party.
The one silver lining I'm trying to see that this could be is Jagmeet Singh represents kind of a new NDP versus the Mulcair or Layton party, which got into a mold of running on retail politics, pejoratively running to the center, however you want to view it. And having space for new blood does give him an opportunity to advance a new kind of party and, you know, have it look like a different force. A lot of people, I think, want to see the NDP take inspiration from some of the vocal strength that's happening in the U.S. right now on the left, the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Yeah, but I think that's kind of also doing the very common mistake of trying to import the American dynamics into Canada where they're not really applicable. Like the internal democratic politics and coalition building is just so much different because they're one of the main two parties. They're don't have a, you know, another party to their flank. Like there's a whole bunch of other stuff that goes on there, and you just can't copy paste the realignment within the internal fractional politics of the Democrats and assume that the NDP can basically copy that and it will be a success here.
No. I wasn't arguing that they do that exactly, but you take somewhere like Nathan Cullen's riding in northern BC, and that's a good opportunity for a local Indigenous leader there to represent what is a very remote riding. Like, it takes him, I think he said, 3 airplane rides to get to Ottawa, and that's a legitimate enough reason to step aside on its own. And in his follow-up comments since announcing his resignation, I think he's actually been very positive towards Ottawa. There's a good opportunity because there's lots of different nations up there that have done a ton of activism, and someone from there can step up, hopefully. The NDP's in a potentially really good spot in theory, because with this SNC-Lavalin scandal, the Liberals have blood all over their hands. The Conservatives don't have a clean historic record because
they've held power before.
Yeah, I was going to say, the charitable way of saying it is that, right? Anyone who holds power eventually gets corrupted. The NDP here doesn't have to pretend it's going to treat SNC with kids' gloves. In fact, a lot of people have commented Jagmeet's been really good this week in terms of saying this is the Liberals playing favorites with their corporate friends. We need a government that stands up for Canadians. We need a public inquiry to get to the bottom of this. And also not going too far. So if he can find some new voices to fill in these ridings. Now, Murray Rankin's is a special case because that's pretty much a orange-green race. So the Green Party is actually, I'm going to bet, take that riding if they pick up another seat.
Yeah, South Island is the obvious spot where they'd be able to add a second member.
And not having a popular incumbent there makes it a lot easier. So, and the NDP losing a seat to the Greens kind of doesn't change the calculus. Not that they're the same party in any way, but if they lose it to the Liberals, that makes a Liberal majority more easy. So we'll see who steps up to run in those couple vacancies. Well, let's finish off with some BC political news. And
it's about time we get to some of that on our BC politics show.
The latest update from the BC legislature spending scandals involving the clerk and sergeant at arms is that the Legislative Assembly Management Committee, LAMC, has appointed former Supreme Court of Canada Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin as their special investigator. That was announced last week. I almost want to make like a little corner at the end of our podcast, which is like how well out of touch Andrew Wilkinson is. Maybe give us a segment name, dear listeners. But
I think this is only the second real example we've had recently. It's just really notable.
We haven't been looking for them.
I think why he's kind of really tarting on this time. But the thing he said was...
Well, so last week we talked about him talking about how renting is just a wacky time of life. He walked that back saying, you know, that was my experience. And I'm sorry if anyone was offended by that. It wasn't a perfect apology, but he tried, I think. This time, he was asked about or decided to go on about the BCNDP's decision to take interest off student loans. And when we talked about that, I think we both saw it as a fairly reasonable policy. There's still interest on federal loans and doesn't cost that much. And it makes education a little bit more affordable. Like maybe it's not the best way to make education more affordable, but it's not a terrible policy.
Yeah, it's definitely not the optimum. I mean, it's a politically good move because like the like marginal constituency on this one, the 30-something young professionals who are still paying off their student loans are much more of a swing demographic than the poor 18-year-olds who could use a more direct funding method if we're going to spend, what, $300 million a year?
No, it was $300 million in total over 3 years. $300
million total, but yeah.
And most of that is paying off the interest.
Yeah, but like if we were to spend, like, there's definitely, I think, on a pure policy grounds argument, the case that that money is much more better spent doing a direct targeted at the current batch of students rather than helping middle class people pay down their student loans a little quicker.
But none of that nuance was in Wilkinson's statements this week to reporters, where he said the concern with the NDP taking the interest off student loans completely is that students in their early years may get a little carried away with how much they are borrowing. And he went on to go, you know, students need some counseling about the debt they are taking on. You know, it's not so much that students need to learn the hard lessons of crippling debt and interest, but if you don't have that anvil hanging over your head of crippling interest, you're just going to get carried away. You're just going to take all the money out, won't you?
So to at least try and give the most charitable interpretation of this, in like the abstract like economics argument of just goods in the, you know, economy, like not focusing on student loans and education in particular, like that's fairly reasonable bit of argumentation in that, you know, you lower the costs, you know, people might consume more than they otherwise would. It doesn't hold up as well when you kind of look at this particular thing, in part because 18-year-olds aren't exactly great at intuiting interest payments over the course of a decade or two and necessarily running the rational calculation on that. But like I can at least understanding like the general framework that Wilkinson would be looking at those sorts of questions, see how he would naturally apply it to this. It's still not great, but like I can at least see how he gets here without it being an inherently out of touch thing. But I don't think it holds up to a deeper level of scrutiny.
Well, and Tom Fletcher, a BC Ledge reporter and columnist for Black Press Media, tweeted out that Horgan was taking some pot shots at Wilkinson's comments about rent and his call for interest to continue on student loans. And Wilkinson took to Twitter to try to set the record straight. And he said, "This story is just plain wrong. I'm not calling for the reinstatement of interest on student loans. I'm suggesting that interest-free student loans should be supported with credit counseling. Any suggestion otherwise is a complete falsehood. Hashtag BC Poly." It's not that he wants there to be interest on there. He just wants anyone who takes out a loan to have to go to mandatory loan school.
It's a little patronizing.
It's a lot patronizing.
Yeah. I think kind of as I said a moment ago, like people entering college aren't necessarily always doing the entire rational evaluation of these sorts of things. And like it's, once again, I can kind of see how he gets there, but it's missing some other details that kind of make it well patronizing.
And it, again, paints him as sort of out of touch, focused on people who are either fairly well-to-do or essentially not students, working class, renters. And frustratingly, this comes in the same week as the BC Liberals actually introduced a private members bill that I'm really supportive of. And this is a simple bill that would require companies, as far as I understand it, to disclose essentially the gender pay gap in their company. Not do anything about it, but just try to get some information out there to hopefully pressure or create pressure to close those pay gaps. And I would hope the NDP would go farther, but for a Liberal position of let the market sort itself out, having that extra information is out there, and it's a good bill. Nevertheless, it still gets called like too far to the left for even suggesting that. But like the BC Liberals have some good ideas, and they just get buried by the like Mr. Monopoly Man villain that he so easily plays.
Yeah, it's irritating. I want to be able to like the Liberals, but this sort of thing is not helping. And it's democracy works best when there's a strong opposition party that can make credible claims on having a better approach to things. These comments have over the last 2 weeks have not helped with that at all. And like, just tweet them a little, even. Like, there's a constituency out there of, you know, renters who starting out, going through that wacky time, as he called it, who, you know, eventually want to be business people, homeowners, that sort of thing. But like, this doesn't help them now. And like, those are the types of people who, you know, would be quite open to the Liberals' messaging. But like, this sort of thing does not help get those people on side at all, because it's, a little disconnected from the current experience that so many are dealing with. And that has been Politos. Find links to everything we talked about at politos.ca. If you're a first-time listener, make sure to subscribe and let us know what you think. Support the show and get access to our exclusive Slack channel at patreon.com/politos. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Sergei Plotnikov. Thanks for listening.